Robin Hood Radio and the Robin Hood Radio Network is proud to present Leonard Lopate at Large, lively hour-long in-depth discussions providing overviews and context to topics usually covered in partial measures. His guests include leading thinkers, scientists, artists, economists, farmers, historians, authors, and politicians. Mr. Lopate is a Peabody Award winner whose numerous honors include 3 Associated Press Awards and 3 James Beard Awards.
Welcome to Leonard Lopate at Large. I'm Leonard Lopate. Climate change and its ramifications have led landscape architects and planners to reevaluate the role of city parks and begin creating environmentally friendly green spaces. Susanna Drake, the founder of D-Land Studio, has been at the forefront of this new movement, creating designs for everything from intimate gardens to large-scale urban planning initiatives, always with an eye toward protecting and restoring native ecosystems. In New York City, her projects include the Gowanus Sponge Park, which just won the Municipal Arts Society's 2018 Masterworks Award for Best Urban Landscape, and the Queensway, which will transform a 3.5-mile stretch of abandoned railway into a family-friendly park. And I'm very pleased to welcome Susanna Drake to our show now.
Hello. Well, thank you for having me here.
Is there a basic concept or aesthetic that ties all of your work together?
Well, I think one of the things that we're trying to do is make urban landscapes more environmentally productive. We're trying to make beautiful landscapes that also serve additional purposes.
Is this something that they teach you in college?
Well, I was an art history major undergrad, so I think I learned more about the aesthetics of parks than the functionality of parks.
Has an emphasis on environmental concerns always been a part of your design practice?
Well, it's been a part of my life. I grew up in Vermont, and you know, I remember as a child participating in Green Up Day, where we would go out and clean up after the snow melted and pick up all the garbage. And my father was a geophysicist, so you know, I think that also played into my expertise and my interest in the environment.
Because I was wondering if this approach is a departure from the traditional landscape approach to landscape design.
Well, not necessarily. I would say Frederick Law Olmsted, the father of landscape architecture, really employed this kind of multidisciplinary environmental approach that also involved aesthetics.
Although Central Park is quite different from Prospect Park.
Well, that's true. But I guess I'm thinking of the Back Bay Fens up in Boston, which is really a kind of both a public landscape and a landscape that cleans the city. It helped to flush out the water and clean that water.
And that's something that we will discuss. It's an issue right now here in the city.
Exactly.
How has the recent increase in our awareness of climate change affected the field of landscape architecture?
Well, I think there's been a tremendous interest in sort of transforming the profession. I would say We kind of go back and forth as a profession. If you look at Olmsted, his focus was both environmental and formal. And
making
about
a beautiful
people,
space.
Exactly, but also about people. And then I would say that there was in the middle of the century, you know, modernism had much more to do with formality, creating spaces that were based on a design that wasn't related to the environment necessarily. And then I would say in the early 70s, of course, I'm grossly generalizing, but in the early 70s, I would say we reverted to an idea of landscape planning that had more to do with larger scale environmental moves in landscape architecture. And I think now we're at this hybrid point where we're bringing it back together. But we're also at a point where we're trying to manage a lot of the major infrastructure projects or ameliorate some of the impacts of some of the major infrastructure projects that were implemented in the post-war period.
In the past, were cities thought to pretty much no longer have any native flora and fauna worth considering? Just pigeons and squirrels?
Well, they are part of the ecosystem. You know, now we have coyotes and we have, you know, lots of different animals in the city. I think, you know, part of the issue is that when you're working in an urban environment, you want things that will live. And I think, you know, some of the issues have to do with, you know, planting things that can actually survive. And there is an argument that native species will survive better. But then there's also an issue of availability. So,
but native species were largely eliminated with the creation of the cities as opposed to the suburbs where we're more likely to find a wider range of animals and plants.
Well, that's true because we've created a much more constrained environment. So it's harder for a broad array of species to survive.
Was the value of green space to improving air quality recognized in the past as it is today?
Well, that's a hard question to answer. I think the understanding of how landscapes can affect air quality is much better understood today than it was. And I think also the relationship between, say, larger infrastructure systems, say the Brooklyn-Queens Expressway, and areas where there's very poor air quality are much better understood, and they're being mapped and exposed. And I think that's a really big issue.
Do you make a point of using native plants whenever possible?
Well, I do, to the degree that I can. I do a lot of work with the New York City Parks Department, and in that capacity, we have kind of a range of plants that we're allowed to use, and some are native. I think there's a
You're allowed to use?
Well, yeah.
They tell you what you can use and you can't use?
Well, they do, because they have to maintain the landscapes. And in some places, we're using more sort of pure natives, and in other places we're working with more hybrids. But there is a set of street trees that are allowed trees, and I think that is wise, because it has to do with their overall management.
Well, I've always wondered about London Plains, because they are totally non-indigenous trees. They have nothing to do with our environment. They were brought in simply because they were hardy.
Well, and also they were Robert Moses's favorite tree. So that's why you see them everywhere, right?
His name comes up all the time, whether you want it to or not.
But you know, the great thing about the London Plain is that it actually has a better capacity to absorb some of the toxins that are in the air than some other trees. The surface area of those leaves is actually very helpful.
Do you use plants that attract pollinators like bees and butterflies?
We try to. Actually, my great uncle was the foremost expert on monarch butterflies. And so we try to put monarch attracting species into all of our landscapes.
Milkweed in our parks?
Well, yes. And there are varieties of milkweed that are actually very beautiful. They aren't the kinds of milkweed that I grew up with, the sort of wild milkweed. But they have the same sort of attractive qualities for the monarchs.
Parks are also being used in different ways today. Skateboarders, yoga classes, runners, bicyclists, and other fitness enthusiasts are all vying for space. And even playground equipment seems to have changed. Have we seen the last of seesaws and monkey bars?
Well, I think we have a better understanding of safety than when I was a child. And so the requirements are different, and the space that playground equipment takes up is greater, because we're actually planning for kids to fall, and we want them to fall in a way that they don't get hurt. And so those tolerances are different. I think, when people think of parks now, they often think of them as being these kind of recreation machines, and it would be nice if there could be a greater balance between that and the passive aspects of park space, in my opinion.
And so when you're planning a park, do you have to take all of those things into consideration?
Well, absolutely. I mean, I think you want to think about your users first and foremost. But then you also need to think about how the park is being maintained, because if it's not being maintained well, it's not going to serve the users.
How do you come to a new project? Do you mostly work for cities and create new parks on public land, or do you also do projects for private groups?
Well, when I started my firm, I would say I did more private work, but I do mostly public work. The methodology that we employ is somewhat different than other landscape architects and other designers, because sometimes we work with not-for-profits, and we write grants for them and with them, and then we get funding from, say, the New England Interstate Water Pollution Control Commission, or the Environmental Facilities Corporation, or the Department of Environmental Protection, or the Department of Environmental Conservation. So we look for funding that helps our clients, and we partner with them to make projects happen. So it's really a grassroots approach.
What are the most important factors that you take into consideration when you're beginning to work on a new project? Do you look at the location, I'm assuming, the proximity to water sources, see what's already growing there, native wildlife?
Well, a lot of those things. I think what we try to do is undertake a fairly involved research process process so that we understand the soils, we understand the geology, we understand whether it's been flooded before, but we also really understand the demographics, like who's going to use it and why and how are they going to circulate through the site, what are the adjacent programs, you know, what are the issues in that neighborhood. And we try to bring all of that together.
So you solicit input not only from elected officials, but also the residents of a neighborhood?
Well, you know, the elected officials are supposed to represent the people in the neighborhood, but oftentimes there are a lot of different voices, and you want to hear the nuances in those voices mm-hmm. when you're designing, because that can really add a lot of richness to the projects.
In this city, after Hurricane Sandy and other major storms, we have come to realize just how fragile our coastal areas are. Did Sandy change the way that you look at a waterfront site?
Well, as I said, I grew up the daughter of a geophysicist who said, you know, Susanna, when you're growing up, never buy a house or build a house in a floodplain. So from, I'd say, the age of six, I knew that.
And why haven't more people realized that is a good idea?
Well, because we have, you know, this romantic attraction to the water. I mean, it's wonderful to live on the water. It's beautiful. There's a sound of the waves. There's a view of the horizon. I mean, there are lots of really compelling aspects to living on the waterfront. It also, you know, I think because of people's love of it, tends to be the highest value real estate. But it's a really compromised situation or area, and it's something that I think we need to sort of change the way that we operate around that idea, because it's dangerous. You know, it's beautiful and it's dangerous. We can visit, but maybe we shouldn't be housed there permanently.
Does it matter whether the water is a beach off the ocean or a river or a lake?
Well, I think lakes are somewhat more stable. But,
so if you want to have a boat, buy a house near the lake.
Well, I mean, you can have a boat if you're living on the ocean, too, or if you're living by a river. But I would just say don't put your house right there. You know, don't put the things that you value keeping right there.
Like those beach bungalows.
The beach bungalow actually makes a lot of sense if it's purely a bungalow or a cottage. You know, something that isn't your permanent residence. And that's the way we historically built on the water. We didn't put our most valuable assets in a place that was vulnerable.
In 2010, even before Sandy, you created a project called A New Urban Ground for the Museum of Modern Art's Rising Currents exhibition. What did that project entail?
Well, it's interesting. I think a lot of people remember that project because it showed Lower Manhattan with a whole series of barrier islands that would help to ameliorate the sort of force of big storm surges. But one of the other aspects of that project that I think people didn't see was that we also completely transformed the subgrade infrastructure of Lower Manhattan to absorb that excess water. So we elevated the level of the waterfront by 6 feet, or the edge of the water by 6 feet, or the edge of the land by 6 feet, rather, and then really rebuilt all of the infrastructure so that if there was a flood, it would be protected. So we had these waterproof vaults. We had areas that could absorb water. We made permeable streets throughout that could absorb the sort of regular rainfall. It was a whole integrated system.
You created marshes or wetlands to absorb the excess water?
We did. One of the things we did was calculate the area that we had in Manhattan and the volume of water that would hit the island in a rainfall event. And we planned it for the 1.2-inch storm, which was the state standard at the time. And so we calculated the amount of wetland space that we would need in order to absorb that water. So we had these wetland spaces that would absorb that water. And then we also had sort of more traditional parks for recreation. And then we had these salt marshes for breaking the force of the waves.
And if that project had been realized before Sandy hit, do you think it might have lessened the storm damage?
Well, probably, because the lights wouldn't have gone out in Lower Manhattan. I mean, but you know, I say that. It's easy for me to say that. You know, it's the Monday morning quarterback, right? But or I guess it would be Tuesday morning. Mm-hmm. Anyway, but you know, it takes so long to get things built that there's no way that our project could have been built in 2 years. So, you know, yes, if you could snap your fingers and have a major infrastructure project happen in the city immediately, sure, it could be protected. But, you know, not at the scale that these things happen, particularly in New York City with all the approvals.
Which we will get to. My guest is Susanna Drake, the founder of DLand Studio. This is Leonard Lopate at Large on WBAI New York, 99.5 FM. One of your major projects is the Gowanus Sponge Park. Now, sponge is the important word there?
Sponge is the important word. And it's funny, when I talk about it, people ask me, so where is the sponge? You know, where are you using some special materials? And
are you?
And no, actually, but...
Aren't there things that do soak up water, that absorb water?
Well, we're using engineered soils, and we're using plants that really absorb that water and like that marshy condition. But the issue was that I needed a euphemism for a wetland or a swamp, because basically what we're doing is creating these landscapes that can soak up that water. And those landscapes historically would have been the swamps that were in the Gowanus before we created the industrial landscape.
We got rid of them. But they were actually protecting the environment initially. Nature was doing it by itself.
Exactly. And so what we're doing is creating a modular version of what was there.
So what is the goal of Sponge Park? To prevent the canal from overflowing and flooding adjacent areas during heavy rainstorms?
Well, that's not actually the main purpose. The main purpose is to absorb and clean the upland water that's flowing into the canal. So there's water that flows over the surface of the roads that has contaminants in it, and then there's water that is going into our combined sewers. And so what we're trying to do is reduce that water that's flowing from heavy rainstorms and keep that from polluting the Gowanus Canal.
And how do you address the canal's notorious pollution? When it overflows, should I assume that the water is especially toxic?
Well, the water is especially toxic.
It's gotten better. It used to really smell bad.
Well, it did. They the Department of Environmental Protection fixed the flushing tunnel that takes water from the East River over through to the Gowanus so that there is a mechanism for creating flow, and I think that's helped dramatically.
It's affected other areas. Carroll Gardens used to have a bad odor, and that's totally gone now.
Yeah, it's much better. It's definitely much better. I think the EPA Superfund process is going to try to clean out a lot of the toxins that are in the sediment. So there are kind of two issues. There's the combined sewer overflows, and then there's the pollution that is from the historic industrial uses. And so I think the combination of reducing combined sewer overflows and also taking away those historic industrial contaminants will make it cleaner eventually.
In the past, the area was mostly industrial, but in recent years, there's been a lot of residential development along the Gowanus. There's even a Whole Foods store along the canal. Has all that new development increased the incentive to get the canal cleaned up?
Well, I think so. And I think that in the Bloomberg administration, they were committed to doing it on their own without the EPA Superfund. But I think there was a lot of political... there were political incentives to actually also have the Superfund people involved. And that's, you know, certainly made it a different place.
And I assume that you have to deal with political considerations on pretty much every project you do, whether it's in New York or elsewhere.
Yeah, absolutely. And here it's probably worse. I mean, I can't imagine it. Well, actually, things happen a lot faster in other cities. Let's just put it that way.
But you say that the de Blasio administration isn't all that interested in creating new parks.
Well, you know, that's probably not a very political thing for me to sort of say, but
They want to fix old parks?
They're fixing a lot of old parks, and we've been part of the Community Parks Initiative, which I have to say has been an amazing program, because not only have we fixed up a lot of parks around the city in underserved neighborhoods, but we've also done it very quickly. So that's been a sea change in capital projects at the Parks Department. Having a project go from design to ribbon cutting in such a short period of time was remarkable.
How do you do that?
Well, part of the way that you do that is that you create very specific milestones in the design process, and you get fast approvals from the Parks Department, and that you, when you make a decision, you stick with that decision. So those are a couple of things. And then I think also setting proper budgets when you go into a project, that's a key element. And then they also used very standard materials. So there was no customization. But I think that probably didn't affect the timetable as much as having the decision-making process expedited.
So what does the Gowanus Sponge Park consist of? Does it look like any other waterfront park with walkways and plantings?
Well, sort of. It has walkways and it has plantings. But I would say that the Sponge Park, this first pilot piece that we built, is really a new piece of infrastructure. So it's like a larger bioswale that also allows for people to hang out around it and near it. So it's something that can be replicated at every street end in the city. We designed it in a way that it can be assembled very quickly and easily by even a low-bid contractor. Actually, our contractors were the low-bid contractors for it, and they were amazing. They were so good. You know, it's really trying to be something that can become a new city standard. And our reasoning behind that is that each one of these sponge parks absorbs, or street ends, absorbs about 2 million gallons of stormwater per year. So, you know, if you actually look at that citywide, if implementation citywide, it ends up being about 800 Wow. million gallons per year. That's a lot of water.
Do you put in plants that take up excess water?
Well, we put in plants that are absorbing water. I can't say that they take excess water, but we did use plants that can take the toxins out of the water. They'll break down some of the biological toxins, and they absorb some of the chemical toxins.
And it's not complete yet, but when will it be completed, do we know?
Well, when we did the master plan for the Sponge Park, it called for a flexible process that could involve a lot of different designers working in different places. The street end is kind of one component of it, of the master plan, so these street ends can go in everywhere. We're working on another street end now and a site adjacent to Thomas Green Park, so that one's happening. I'm not giving you a solid date because it's impossible for me to know, because a lot of the landscapes that we proposed, you know, some of them are on private property, some of them are on public property. It's you know, it's all an evolving process. But I would say probably in about 20 years we'll see a big difference.
This summer was quite rainy. Do you feel the project has already made a difference?
Well, I do. You know, we had some funds for monitoring its performance for the first couple of years, and we saw some positive impacts at that point, or after we finished the monitoring. And, you know, it's continuing to perform. The plants are growing really well. You know, people are using it. I see lots of people down there now.
And I understand Jared Kushner is building some buildings there, so maybe Washington will even be happy with this project.
Yeah, I can't imagine Donald Trump ever going to the Gowanus Canal, but we'll see.
Well, he's from Queens. What about your proposal for the Queensway?
Oh, good segue. I like that.
Queensway, as I said, is a 3.5-mile stretch of abandoned rail line.
Yes.
This is the rail line where people from the Rockaways used to travel into the rest of the city?
Right. It's the old Long Island branch, or an old branch of the Long Island Railroad, and or the Rockaway Line, rather. So it's an abandoned railway. It's been abandoned for about 60 years. Most of the land is decast property, so it's in this kind of holding capacity with the city.
So it's just been sitting idle all this time?
Idle. And one of the things that's really wonderful about that is that the trees have had a chance to grow. A lot of native species have grown up. Unfortunately, a lot of invasive species have also come in. So, you know, it's almost like you have this instant landscape with these big mature trees. And what we have to do is very careful editing to try to make it a publicly usable landscape.
Does the MTA or the city own this land?
No. Well, the city owns it. Yeah. Yes. So it's the DCAS. Sorry. And then part of it is actually owned by the New York City Parks Department, the part that runs through Forest Park.
So this is near Forest Park? What neighborhoods does this affect?
It basically goes...
Forest Park is one of the great parks of the city, one of the great old parks of the city.
It is a beautiful park. So on the southern end, we're in Ozone Park, and then we go all the way up I'm totally drawing a blank.
Well, okay, but it's sorry. It's in that area.
It basically, yes, it goes from.
Okay, well, anyway, and then you also have a new pedestrian bridge over the Long Island Railroad tracks.
We do, and that connects to the Metropolitan Expeditionary Learning Academy, or Learning School, MELS, which is right in the kind of center portion of the site. It's right off of Metropolitan Avenue. Mm-hmm. So that's an area that has the school on one side and neighborhoods on one side, and it has some of the big box stores on the other side. And one of the challenges is that the kids, they can't really safely ride their bike to school, and they can't really safely ride their bikes from school over to Forest Park. Access to Forest Park is actually a really big issue. It's most of the people that go there actually go by car.
I used to go by the Jamaica line.
Okay.
the elevated train. Will the Queensway be based on the design of the High Line?
Well, no.
Because the High Line was such a major success, it's been imitated all over the country.
Well, people talk about imitating it all over the country. I think the High Line is a very, very beautiful garden. It's very highly manicured. It's probably one of the most expensive. Actually, I know it's one of the most expensive parks in the country. We're talking about a landscape that's serving sort of more different constituents, let's say.
Well, it's a much larger area, isn't it, also?
It's much bigger. Yeah, it's 3.5 miles long, and it doesn't have the kind of concentrations of wealth that you have in Manhattan, frankly. And it doesn't have the same kind of development potential, at least right now. It may in the future, but it doesn't right now. So we really have to make it much more of a public park. We're also trying to make it a park that can serve the whole community. We want you to be able to have your stroller on the park, to have bikes, to have dogs, to have kids. Not kids are allowed on the High Line, but it's trying to be a much more inclusive landscape, and it also has to be maintained by the Parks Department, potentially, or some public entity, without the same kind of capital infusions that the High Line has.
Well, since it's such a large project, I'm guessing it'll cost a lot to turn it into a park. Does the funding come entirely from the city, or can you get funds from other sources?
Well, we're trying to find funds from a lot of different sources. Because it's running from Forest Hills down to Ozone Park, there's a very sort of broad potential constituency. We're looking for, sources of funding that might be corporate, might be foundation. The Trust for Public Land has been very involved in that effort. The Friends of the Queensway has been part of that effort, but they haven't found the kind of the major donor at this point.
As a landscape designer, do you always have to be concerned with costs? Do you sometimes have to make compromises to your ideal designs because of budget constraints?
Well, I think a good design is one that takes the budget into consideration and then tries to do as much as you can with that budget. It'd be great to have all the money in the world, but, we try to work with what we have.
Does it need to be approved by the New York City Planning Commission or the City Council?
Well, the New York City Planning Department doesn't really approve a lot of planning projects in the city. It's a decentralized system. We haven't determined which agency is actually going to have the purview to do those approvals yet. because the land is in DCAS ownership. So that's unclear. I would say there are a number of different city council districts through which this corridor runs, so we need consensus on it from them. So there would need to be approval on that basis.
This is Leonard Lopate at Large. I'm talking with Susanna Drake, the founder of D-Land Studios, about designing parks in the city. We are talking about now about Queensway, which will transform a 3.5-mile stretch of abandoned railway into a family-friendly park. What stage is the project at right now?
Well, we're working with the Trust for Public Land and the Friends of the Queensway. The TPL helped them get a grant to do drawings for a first section of the Queensway.
The TPL being?
Trust for Public Land. And that first section is around Mel's, the school that I mentioned before. So we've been working very closely with the principal there and with the teachers to develop a plan that actually, you know, builds upon their educational mission. And so that area it will be the first kind of prototypical section. And we've taken those drawings through design development at this stage.
You've called it Every Man's High Line because it would benefit 320,000 people living within a mile of it. But the problem is that the trail crosses through diverse communities, making political mobilization more challenging. What are the problems?
Well, you know, I think if you have a park and that is more centralized with a specific demographic that surrounds it, with, say, one city council group or one congressional office, it's a little bit easier to get consensus. You know, we have people running from, you know, the higher affluence in Forest Hills down to, you know, more diverse and less affluent area in Ozone Park, and getting consensus around all those different communities is hard.
Don't some people living in the Rockaways imagine that it might be a train line again after 60 years?
Well, there is that suggestion. I don't think it's particularly realistic, given that it's been 60 years and nothing has happened, and given that it takes so long to get infrastructure projects completed, that by the time a train was built, you know, the Rockaways will be underwater.
Because of rising sea levels?
Exactly.
Is there no way to prevent that from happening? I know that's not your purview.
Well, it's part of my interest.
But I mean, there's been beach erosion for a while now.
There has been, and there have been, you know, there are extraordinary measures that are taken to protect coastal environments that really shouldn't have permanent housing on them, in my opinion. We're building additional barrier islands that are similar to the barrier islands that used to protect the upland resources, you know, as a sort of stopgap. But, you know, in the long term, those barrier islands probably need to go back to their dynamic state.
Of abandoned rail line in Long Island City has been turned into a community garden called Smiling Hogshead Ranch. But that's a volunteer effort by a group of young gardeners. Does the MTA encourage people to come up with proposals for sites like that?
You know, I'm not aware. I don't know. I would say that the public agencies have become much more open and creative in my time practicing in New York. So, you know, I encourage that.
Well, because community gardens were under threat at one point, and now they seem to be making a comeback.
Well, community gardens, yes and no. You know, I think there are lots of people that are interested in participating in community gardens, and I think there have been there is now sort of proven data that shows the value of that in terms of reducing crime, in terms of improving the value of neighborhoods, even improving public health. So, you know, with those metrics coming out, I think there's a little bit more ammunition for keeping these public gardens and making new ones.
One of your other projects is Alley Pond Environmental Center, which is also in Queens. What is that? Is that an educational facility?
It is. And that's one of the ones that I kind of wish was a Community Parks Initiative project, because we finished the drawings for that about 6 years ago, and it's been sort of stuck in a bureaucratic process. So, you know, this I think, great design that we did isn't serving the community. But it's an environmental center with classrooms for kids and public programming. And it the building that was designed by Leroy Street Studio, the great architects, forms a threshold to the trails and natural systems behind it. So it's an incredible resource, and I really hope we can get it built soon.
Another project that you are working on came as a big surprise to me, the BQ Green. That's a park to be built over the BQE in Williamsburg?
Well, so the BQE, the BQ Green started through a grant that I got from the New York State Council on the Arts, where I was imagining capping the Brooklyn Queens Expressway in Carroll Gardens and Cobble Hill. And that vision prompted Nydia Velasquez to bring us in through St. Nick's Alliance to design a new park over the BQE in Les Sures, which is Southside Williamsburg.
Haven't similar things been done in other cities like the Freeway Park in Seattle? Would this be similar?
Well, Freeway Park was a really early example and a very strong example. It was also done in Dallas with a public park that was being designed around the same time that we designed our park.
On the other hand, isn't the troubled Brooklyn Heights promenade built over another stretch of the BQE? That's a cantilever. How would your project be different?
Well, our park is actually filling in between bridges. So when we did this initial work, we did a lot of research on the BQE, and the BQE was built in sections. Now, saying that the cantilever is troubled is a little bit...
Well, they say it's falling.
Well, it is, but that's because even engineered landscapes need to be maintained. These landscapes have lives. So the Brooklyn Queens Expressway bridges and that cantilever were designed for like a 50 or 60 year lifespan, right? So they were due to be maintained. We just didn't plan the maintenance into those projects. But what we're doing is actually saying, okay, if the bridges over the trench need to be replaced or maintained, while we're doing that work, while we're creating the disruption, let's make a public park and serve the 200,000 people that live there.
So is how to repair the highway without closing the park something you have to take into consideration when you're planning a park of that kind?
Yes, absolutely. I think thinking about the sort of mobilization and construction of these things is essential when you're designing urban landscapes, because it's not like we can shut down the city to get them done.
Although there are some people who suggested that the entire BQE be turned into a park at certain stretches, like the lead up on both sides of the Cascuso Bridge. It's like a parking lot. So
I know, it is crazy. Well, it's funny. I did a scheme for filling in the Gowanus Canal also and turning it into a park. And it would have been a lot cheaper than the Superfund. But, but you know, these visions are visions. Some of them are more likely to happen than others.
Is designing a park over an expressway similar to creating a park along a rail line? Because they're both linear?
Well, no, actually, because yes, they are if it was a very long stretch of highway that we were covering, but we're actually covering quite a small area. We're filling in between highway bridges. We're only creating a couple of acres of landscape there.
Where would that be? South Fifth Street? Broadway?
It's basically between Broadway and Borinquen. Mm-hmm. So it's Les Sures, predominantly Latino neighborhood. And
where I grew up and went to high school, yeah. Eastern District High School.
Yeah. Well, Diana...
That doesn't exist anymore.
Diana Reyna tells a very compelling story about growing up there and getting caught in the crossfire of a fight between rival gangs, and how she had to hide behind a water fountain to avoid being shot. And so her vision, her idea is that by making this park, you're sort of eliminating or reducing the territories of these gangs. You're making an open space that allows for more people and more play. And you're also providing an amenity for kids to recreate instead of getting involved in the gangs.
Is it also something that a city with limited space like New York needs to do more of?
Well, absolutely. And when I started my firm, that was really one of the principal motivations, was to look for all the leftover spaces that exist and operate in those areas to make new open space.
One aspect of building a park over a highway is mitigation of air and noise pollution. How do you do that?
Well, those were things that we definitely looked at. One of the issues with noise is that the best way to manage it is to block it. So we looked for some methods to block the sound, particularly in relation to some of the neighboring uses, like the there was a school that was right next door. We looked for at using earthen strategies and planted strategies in terms of the particulate matter or the air quality. We were employing some very innovative methods for absorbing that particulate matter and trying to make the air cleaner. So it was all part of the feasibility study that we did for a sort of second phase of the planning.
Because improving air quality is something that comes along with creating parks, but it's something that we actually need to do in this city, although we don't have the worst air quality of major cities in America.
No, that's true. We're better than
LA
some.
LA used to be really bad, but now more and more cars in the city, and I'm suspecting the air quality is deteriorating a bit.
Well, particularly with reduced emission standards that we may be getting down the pike, that could be an issue. We just need a base standard that's better. I mean, we have these areas. Like if you actually look at a map of the highways in New York City and the toxicity or the amount of particulate matter in the air, and then also compare that with the asthma rates, you can see really high rates of asthma in these zones that are next to the highway, where you're having this sort of constant stream of bad air.
And we brought up Robert Moses earlier. He wanted to create major roadways all throughout the city, including knocking down Soho. We could only imagine what the air quality of Lower Manhattan would be like if that one had gone through.
That's true. It's interesting. He had a great vision for creating parks and playgrounds, and
he gave us Riverside Park, good park.
Exactly, and that's actually another good example of a decked park, because Moses's work actually extended Riverside Park over the rail lines, right? So it's actually on deck. But I think, in a close reading of the Power Broker, you can see that his early idealistic visions of making parks accessible to people, putting recreation space in older parks, adding playgrounds throughout the city, and providing these conduits for people to get out of the city to some of the public pools and beaches, was really sort of wonderful and aspirational. But then there's the dark side, right? Then there's the proposals for Soho. There's the what happened with the Cross Bronx Expressway, the sort of what he's known for.
But at that time, he was the person who could get things done, and he was a government official. Is the weight now on the shoulders of people like you?
Well, I would say that we all learned lessons from Robert Moses about how to get things done. We understand the complexity of the processes, and we try to operate around those systems, both with and around them. And I would say that there are structures in place that are remnants of his thinking that enable projects to happen faster, like, for instance, the Economic Development Corporation or any of these development corporations that operate around normal city processes. They're all there to cut through the red tape. We do it, my whole process of working with grants was a methodology for operating around the normal systems.
We know that new parks raise real estate values in a neighborhood. We have seen that with the City Line. Mm-hmm. So isn't it in the city's interest to create as many new parks as possible?
Well, yes, it is.
Why do you think the de Blasio administration is resisting that? Is it just simply a matter of money or philosophy?
Well, I think it's an issue of focus. So they're primarily focused on making new housing. And so the parks that are being created tend to relate to the new housing that's going in. And then by fostering that relationship, you can also get private funds going into the development of these new public-private parks. So, you know, I think that's happening. And we've seen some extraordinary projects happen that are, you know, conveniently near a lot of these really nice new housing developments that also happen to have an inclusionary, you know, aspect. So, you know, that's my kind of opinion on what's been going on.
You've also suggested a new coastal economic zone that would be modeled on BLM land?
Okay, so that has to do with our work with the Regional Plan Association. We won a competition. I was working with, my firm, D-Land Studio, was working with professors at MIT, Rafi Siegel in particular. Rafi and I had taught studios together at the Cooper Union, and we decided to enter this competition, and we won the opportunity to design the waterfront of Long Island, New York City, and New Jersey. And one of our prototypical projects looked at Jamaica Bay. And, you know, that's why I was talking about the Rockaway and how we were actually very focused on that. So as part of our analysis, what we recognized was that there were these upland corridors, so transportation corridors, highways and train lines that were on high ground that were underbuilt. And then there's also this landscape between that and what was the water line, that this zone that is highly constrained by federal, state, and city regulatory processes. So we thought, why don't we move the development to those underdeveloped corridors and then make a new zone that is akin to BLM land, that is the area that's in these compromised situations, or in a land that's vulnerable to climate change impacts.
In the past, a lot of the land that you're talking about was used for shipping in along the Jersey coast, in Brooklyn, Red Hook, for example, all along the Hudson River. We've seen a few parks developed there, but to a large degree, for example, Red Hook, much of that area has just simply been allowed to kind of fall apart.
Well, we're a post-industrial city, so, you know, we need to be thinking about new uses for the waterfront. The shipping in the sort of era of the containerized, you know, mode of transport, you know, putting goods into containers and transferring them to trucks and to trains, doesn't really work.
But that's where those train lines were developed earlier. Most those trains that you were talking about, those train lines, were there because things were coming off the ships.
Well, actually, the train lines that I'm referring to are really sort of in the middle of the. Yeah, I mean, I suppose, but they're train and transportation corridors that were also related to residential development. So those are the ones that I'm really referring to. But regardless, they are rights of way. And they're very valuable rights of way because they are on this high ground and they are public and they provide access for new development.
You've also worked on projects in other cities like St. Louis and Little Rock. In St. Louis, the public media commons the Argenta Plaza in North Little Rock. Have you found that every city presents a different challenge? Do people have different attitudes toward green space in different cities?
Well, they're different. Yes, definitely different attitudes. I think each of those projects relates to our overall work because it's a transformation of derelict space into something that's providing a public amenity. The Media Commons, for instance, was an old parking lot that was turned into a new public plaza, and it engages the neighbors, the public radio station and the public television station and the Sheldon Art Museum, in the programming of that space. They were very involved in the design, and they're very involved with the ongoing programming. And we also, in the case of the St. Louis work, wrote a grant for them and got them a couple $100,000 to do a Project CLEAR grant to absorb stormwater. So it has a lot of the same elements. I would say in North Little Rock, what we did there was really help the mayor understand the value of the indigenous landscape and the patterns in that landscape and how an expression of that would make the plaza a lot stronger.
In New York, many people live in apartments. Do we need more parks than the cities where most of the people live in houses with yards?
Well, absolutely. We need more parks. That was a softball question, right? Yes, we need more parks because, you know, parks make people healthier. Parks make people happier. You know, it's essential to our well-being.
And Adrian Benepe talks about a project where every park should be within at least 10 minutes walk of the local residents.
Yeah, I think Trust for Public Land has a 10-minute walk campaign across the country to make sure that people can walk. And one of the things that I find kind of refreshing is that that I didn't see, say, 10 years ago, was that the real estate agents actually now have a walk score listed in their listings. So I think that's an important development. People care about walking, and people recognize that walking is really good for their health.
Do you have other projects that you're working on that we haven't covered?
Well, let's see. We just started working on another new project in St. Louis, which is a connector, trying to bring together a couple of big public parks, and that'll be really exciting. It runs through a lot of different neighborhoods. It's probably somewhere between Queensway and some of the work that we did in downtown Brooklyn, actually. And then we're also working out in Colorado, doing some campus work.
They don't have enough parks in Colorado?
Well, I would say the other main area of focus of my firm is on campus design, and so we're really excited to be working on the work on the campus of UC Boulder, and we're also working in Hawaii at the University of Colorado, University of Hawaii in Manoa. And I would say, you know, one has issues of water quality that relate to more of a deprivation scheme. And another has water issues that have to do with flooding. So even though we're working in very different landscapes in these different settings, we're still very interested in the sort of the form and the function and the relationship of these programs to water.
Do you have a pet project that you would like to see realized if you were given carte blanche?
Oh, gosh, if I could have anyone realize, like, right now, it would be BQ Green. And I hate to say that because I'd love to see the Queensway happen, but I think the Queensway can happen.
You're not sure about BQ Green?
Well,
because that is, as you point out, an underserved area.
It's an underserved area.
I would think the city would be interested.
And I think one of the things that concerns me is that, you know, as the real estate gets more valuable, the community that's there will get pushed out, and then, you know, the park may happen, but it's not going to serve the people that I made it for.
Well, the BQE, the BQE to some degree destroyed that neighborhood in the same way that the Cross Bronx Expressway destroyed parts of Bronx. I remember when it was built and movie theaters were lost and the local Woolworth, of course there are no Woolworths anymore, but, you know, right. A whole bunch of things. A synagogue was destroyed, all just because it had to go and people had to move, all because they had to have the straight line through Brooklyn.
Mm-hmm.
And a neighborhood was divided as it was in the Bronx.
Right.
So a park might bring it together?
Well, that's the thought, that these severed neighborhoods could be reunited with these strategies. And it doesn't have to be just Southside Williamsburg. I mean, obviously, that's where I would like to see it happen first. But there are many situations around the city where this could make neighborhoods more connected.
Susanna Drake, thank you so much for being on our show. Susanna Drake is the founder of D-Land Studios. We've been talking about creating parks in New York City. And that brings us to the end of our show. My great thanks to Susanna Drake, to Barbara Kahn, who prepared this segment, to Jesse Lent, my assistant producer, who was at the audio controls, to Charlie Morrow, who composed our theme music. Leonard Lopate at Large comes to you on Saturdays at 4 and Tuesdays at noon. You can subscribe to Leonard Lopate at Large podcast on iTunes and by clicking on Robin Hood Radio's archive program site. which is robinhoodradio.com. You can also check out Leonard Lopate at Large Facebook page. We hope to see you next week.